The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction is holding a series of webinars on drug policy, drug use, harm reduction, and treatment in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to hear some audio from one of those today, the most recent webinar in the series entitled, How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe? First, let's hear from Matt Southwell. He's a partner at COACT Expertise in Drug Use and HIV, which is located in Bath, England. He also provides technical support to Bridge Hope Health Organization, and he's a project manager with the European Network of People Who Use Drugs.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me to contribute to this webinar. And Alexis, thank you for your public commitment to the meaningful involvement of people who use drugs. This box represents for me the secondary needle and syringe program that we're running in my hometown of Bath. My normal engagement is to, the other half of my work is to be a technical advisor supporting international development on drugs and HIV. And clearly that was closed down in the COVID lockdown. So, and as drug services withdrew to protect staff from delivering face-to-face services, we scaled up our local peer delivery of needle and syringe programs, peer-to-peer naloxone distribution, and also then spreading messages around the new challenges around COVID, around trying to set up in our own peer-led user-based supply or supplier-based needle and syringe programs, introducing hand washing and trying to encourage people to adopt safer practices, particularly looking at sustaining harm reduction around HIV and hepatitis and managing continued threats of opioid overdose. We had a spike of cocaine injecting during this period, and that was the one of the underlying causes of the Glasgow HIV epidemic. And you know, we're clear that the numbers of needles and syringes being given out during that period, we weathered that storm because we had three or four peer-based secondary needle and syringe programs giving out needles and syringes, often alongside the sale of drugs, to actually make sure that we didn't lose contact with the most vulnerable drug users during the lockdown. We've also been playing a key role in terms of mediating as drug user groups to get our peers into OST services. In my hometown, we had 10 new people enter services, partly because people feel that they, they were very fearful, and therefore entering OST was a protective engagement. But also the fact that treatment is much more liberal, that we are getting weekly take-homes, that there was fast access to services, and services weren't overly dominating and paternalistic and requiring people to engage in daily supervised distribution. New people came forward because of that liberalized approach. And I think as we look to the future, I think we really need to ask questions about why it took a pandemic to introduce what we know is good practice around treatment. Notably, diversion is almost non-existent. All of our reports from all of the drug user groups around Europe is that it's much, much harder to secure street methadone right at this point in time. So really, I think we were all looking to see what would happen when the majority of people were getting weekly take-homes. And I think it's really positive evidence that, when people saw the value in their methadone and saw the protective function that could, could play if they were caught in a lockdown, people responded by looking after that medication and using it in a really constructive and important way. So I think we've the one thing that's really missing in this picture is the issue of crack pipes. We've had a lot of frustration in the UK. We lobbied Public Health England to promote access to crack pipe distribution, arguing that with the respiratory disease, it was critical that we promote crack pipe distribution. Unfortunately, our home office have said no on the grounds that it would be akin to drug liberalisation. Dr. Magdalena Harris is publishing a paper in the International Journal of Drug Policy, setting out the case for crack pipe distribution and reminding us that early harm reduction innovation was often achieved through civil disobedience and watch this space. So it's been an interesting time. We've really used community mobilisation across Europe in many of our different groups. I'm reflecting on my experience in Bath, but it mirrors the work of drug user groups across Europe, playing pivotal roles in helping to keep harm reduction commodities and to keep drug users engaged during these very difficult times.
That was Matt Southwell. He's a project manager with the European Network of People Who Use Drugs. He was speaking at a webinar entitled, How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe? That was hosted recently by the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more from that EMCDDA webinar. Participants were asked if they had known back at the start of 2020 what we know now about the COVID-19 pandemic. What, if anything, would they have done starting on January 1st with that foreknowledge in order to be prepared? Here's Faden Kalatarakis, president of the European Federation of Therapeutic Communities.
The preparedness of any intervention, treatment approach also has to do, I think, with the government's preparedness in some ways. For example, we in Greece, in our therapeutic communities, we did not, so far, we don't have any case of coronavirus infection, any case. But talking with colleagues in Spain or Italy, they do have in their programs people who are infected. So because here the government was very quick to react to the coronavirus, I think that really helped us. But at the same time, I would like to make three points, which sound more, and they probably are more general, but to me, they're also very, very important. The first point is that we do need a stronger voice for the most vulnerable groups of people who use drugs. For example, the refugees, people who are incarcerated, mothers who have children, just to mention a few examples. And I'm talking now about the treatment programs. I'm not talking about advocacy organizations. I'm talking about treatment programs. And we should be more political. And I use the term political in the Aristotelian sense. I'm not talking about partisan politics. I'm talking about citizens who should take a stand. I mean, we do, and we work against stigma, et cetera, but we need that more, because when a crisis like the coronavirus comes along, then the ones who are more vulnerable than others really suffer. So we have to be prepared. We have to do this beforehand. For example, with the refugees that we have in Greece, and we have many refugees, as you might know, because we were not prepared as treatment programs. Now there is a problem, and we're running after it. Okay, so I think we need politically to take a stand as treatment programs, even if we are not advocacy, as I said, organizations. So that's one thing that I would have done differently. If I had to go back to January. Now, the other thing is that we need, it has a twofold aspect. There is a twofold purpose in this. I mean, the one, we have to put a more specialized emphasis on personal health and personal hygiene. I mean, okay. But the second aspect is also political. We have to push for the treatment programs to become an integral part of any national health system. Because when, as I mentioned before, a crisis like the coronavirus pandemic comes, then we can see the big holes in the system. And the holes in the health system have also to do, again, with the most vulnerable, even in health matters, because we focus on drug use, but we should also focus on personal health and personal hygiene, and we have to convince the policymakers that what we do should be an integral part of our national health system. And the third one, okay, it's quite obvious, and everybody, or you know, most people really realize that we can have a more effective use of the internet. Okay, it is too generic. I realize that, but for us, I mean, you cannot substitute physical presence when it comes to treatment and therapy. And especially when we're talking about the psychosocial approach, you cannot do that that effectively online. You cannot substitute. You can, but up to a point. But again, we can do things on a managerial level, meetings and different managerial tasks. They can be done now more effectively online. And we've realized this, and this will bring many changes, and also it would be good for our budgets. For example, we don't have to travel too much to meetings anymore. So these are the three things that I would have done differently in January or before January.
That was Fadon Kalantarakis, president of the European Federation of Therapeutic Communities. He was participating in a webinar entitled, How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe? That was hosted recently by the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction. Here's Tony Duffin, CEO of Analiffi Drug Project, with his response.
Sure. Thank you. So in classic response, if any of you ever get to be asked questions by journalists, you should thank them for the question and then answer the question you want to answer. But I will get back to the question. I'm going to stick to what's on the slide because it will keep me on track. But in mid-March 2020, there was a heightened level of fear and anxiety, as I've alluded to before. Policymakers and practitioners were finding their way to respond to a crisis that no one had experience of. And we were in uncharted territory. And I did talk to Donald Cassidy yesterday on Monday, and we talked at length about this finding our feet. And I think it's really important that I say now that with regard to working with people in Dublin who are homeless, who are at risk of homelessness and who have complex and multiple needs, like problematic drug use, mental health issues, physical health issues, behavioural issues, etc. The state's response of providing extra accommodation, so we provided cocooning units and isolation units for people who were homeless, and improved accessibility of prescription drugs, like methadone and benzodiazepines, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but suffice to say at the moment that in terms of methadone, we went from a 12-week wait to 2 to 3 days, and we can talk about that in a moment. And in terms of benzodiazepines, previously it wasn't permitted to provide stabilization prescriptions, and in certain circumstances now it is, and again, that's something I'll come back to. But this has helped to stabilize people and help them to remain in isolation with their own choosing, because obviously we've provided them with the options, which helps to reduce the spread of COVID-19. And that is very important. I think at the beginning, we were very clear, very quickly, many of us, that our primary job, even though we're a drug service, was to reduce the spread of COVID-19. And that was critical in, you know, coming together and working together. For example, as of the 24th of April 2020 in Dublin City, there had been 33 people within this cohort diagnosed with COVID-19. Three clusters of COVID-19, i.e. two or more cases, had been identified within homeless accommodation. All clusters were of two cases only, and there had been no known COVID-19 related deaths. And I checked with Austin this morning, and I'm pleased to say that still is the case. There has been no known COVID-related deaths amongst people who are homeless, the cohort we're working with, and in terms of people who use drugs as well. So that's very positive, even though obviously there are other difficulties, huge difficulties around COVID-19 in Ireland. This is about this cohort. In the very early days of the crisis, so coming back to the question, in the very early days of the COVID-19 crisis, many of the people we met on outreach simply did not know about COVID-19. So they had no knowledge of the latest advice, what the restrictions were, or how the service provision landscape had changed. Our team spent a lot of time explaining the situation, supporting people around their fears and frustrations, and getting them linked into treatment and housing options. So a upon reflection and getting ready, and I do think, you know, we have to come to terms with the fact, if we haven't already, that we're going to be living with COVID-19 and, for the foreseeable future, that we need to, when we plan, drug service providers who are on the front line, should talk to people as early as possible who use their services about the impact of restrictions and link people into services earlier on to ensure preparedness for future pandemics of COVID-19 waves. So I suppose I'm saying that we're really pleased with what we did. And if we're looking back to January, if we'd known what we know now, perhaps what I'm saying is we could have done it a little bit earlier, but that's just looking to find some sort of critical sort of observation, really. That's my slide. Thank you.
That was Tony Duffin, CEO of Analiffy Drug Project. He was participating in a webinar entitled "How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe?" that was hosted recently by the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction. He was responding to the question of what his agency would have done in order to prepare for the COVID-19 pandemic if we had known at the beginning of January 2020 what we now know about the disease. Here's Matt Southwell, project manager for the European Network of People Who Use Drugs, with his response to that question.
Yes, so I wanted to pick one thing that I'm really happy that we are doing, which is we have got a new project in EuroMPUD called the OST, Treatment Literacy and Rights Project. And this is funded through an unrestricted educational grant from Camarus. And it's a key opportunity for us to champion treatment rights and to champion a more empowered and engaged relationship for people who are dependent on opiates within opiate substitution therapy. I think it's a key opportunity because we have suddenly gained many of the things we've been fighting for many years, rapid assessment and treatment entry, weekly take-home doses, an end to an overly restrictive and intrusive treatment relationship. And suddenly we've gained these things, but many countries have set it as a sort of temporary measure with the idea that would then spring back at the end of this period. So I think one of the things we're really keen to do is to highlight how drug users are really responding progressively, one, by coming into treatment in greater numbers, and two, managing take-homes very positively. And we hope this will lead to a new dialogue around the quality of the management of OST treatment in the future, which could benefit us all by increasing the capacity of treatment and the accessibility of treatment as well, and also allowing us then to focus more resources on those who have the most complex and challenging needs. The bit I wish we could go back to January and change is the fact that we've been developing a project on peer-led harm reduction. We had funding in place, which then fell to pieces at the end of the year, at the beginning of the year, and we've then subsequently tried to bid again and been unsuccessful. That's really meant that in the mid to intervene with our country groups and support them to use community-led harm reduction to really help expand, not just sustain, but also expand the reach of harm reduction in this period when drug services are necessarily pulling back to protect staff and to manage their health and safety responsibilities. I wish we had the resources. I mean, we responded very rapidly by getting a leaflet called COVID-19 Advice for People Who Use Drugs that went out in 20 languages within about 10 days of the epidemic breaking, really helping peers to prepare for what was coming. I wish we'd had the resources to do more and go in and support community-led harm reduction on the ground. I'm frustrated we were left just responding with a leaflet.
That was Matt Southwell, project manager for the European Network of People Who Use Drugs. He was participating in a webinar entitled "How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe?" that was hosted recently by the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction. The title of this recent EMCDDA webinar was "How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe?" With answers to that question, here's Tony Duffin, CEO of Analiffy Drug Project.
Yeah, look, getting back to work safely for many people. Some services had to close down at the beginning because they couldn't guarantee social distancing and such. For our part, we had to close our drop-in service in mid-March and not do not do group work and things like that. So we're looking at how to reorganise ourselves. But suffice to say that we did stay out on outreach. We did carry on with needle exchange. We did obviously do other things that we could do. So the team have been on the ground throughout. Just a few bullet points I have here are the mobilisation of drug services to reduce the spread of COVID-19 has led to increased collaboration. Of course, there was collaboration before, but this has led to an even further meaningful partnership, which, as I said, was led by the HSC from the outset and focused on the primary goal of stopping the spread of COVID-19. And I think I said it already, but I think that focus really brought people together. And then we had the removal of barriers to service provision. So things like methadone waiting times were reduced significantly. So prior to COVID-19, it was 12 weeks to wait for methadone, so 3 months, and now it's 2 to 3 days. And we want to retain that collectively, talking to people. We obviously want to retain going forwards. Also, there has been an innovation with regards to things like benzodiazepine stabilization prescriptions in certain circumstances. That wasn't allowed before. Now in certain circumstances, it is. Of course, it's no surprise that, as I mentioned, providing the accommodation, so many people are cocooning. They're living in a hotel room, a very nice hotel room, perhaps, with an ensuite. They're having their prescription drugs delivered to them by Analifi or indeed our colleagues at Chrysalis, they have food, they are warm. It's no surprise I can say to you, at least anecdotally, that people are happier that they're in that situation, that they are healthier. And we need to evaluate that. We need to be able to prove that. But I'm just telling you from a harm reduction services perspective, who know people in that situation, for many people, things are improved. Their health has improved. So that's an outcome. There is a greater need for a range of addiction-specific interventions and supports to people in their accommodation. If people can't come to services, we've got to go to them. And indeed, we are doing that, and we will continue to do that. The extraordinary services that have been put in place for COVID-19 and could continue certainly to the end of the year and beyond, a little bit beyond. So, and we find our way forward. What I mean by that is harm reduction, community stabilisation and detox, relapse prevention, so providing psychosocial supports as well. And, you know, it's important to me, as my last bullet point, harm reduction will remain an important part of the public health response to drug use in future pandemics or COVID-19 waves, to help reduce the spread of the virus and to minimise drug-related harm. And listening to Matt talk about, you know, not being able to provide crack pipes, it's hugely disappointing to hear that. We do provide crack pipes to people in Ireland, and it is a harm reduction intervention. It is a public health intervention with regards to people's health in terms of their chest and such. So, you know, really, really disappointed to hear that, and any support we can give to Matt, we will. That's my slide. Thank you.
That was Tony Duffin, CEO of Analifi Drug Project. Now here's Matt Southwell, project manager for the European Network of People Who Use Drugs.
So I think the first key issue is I think there's a shared commitment from drug users and also from drug services to sustain the gains that we've made around OST. I think people who are on OST have really demonstrated their ability to manage take-home doses, and I hope we can move forward to a much stronger and sustained meaningful partnership that allows treatment to be something that is much more of a partnership where we respect multiple different treatment outcomes. We recognise the role of high-dose prescribing. We recognise the role of choice around different types of OST treatment, you know, from diamorphine through to depo-buprenorphine and all the various options in between. I think choice is key to people being able to pick the right option for them at the right moment in their life, which may also change over the course of their engagement with drugs. I think we need to really recognise the role that community-based organisations, drug user groups can play in brokering the relationship between people who use drugs. I mean, we have no choice in social distancing or physical distancing. We are working and living in those drug scenes, so therefore continuing to provide education, support, and to think how we manage that. And I endorse the UNAIDS press release that argued for governments to recognise that community services need to be supported with PPE and other issues as well, and not to see us as somehow outside the healthcare system. I think we need to recognise that drug user groups play a pivotal role in harm reduction innovation. It's not surprising that we came out with guidelines within days of this issue breaking, because we have lived experience, we have privileged access into drug scenes, and we have a really detailed understanding of how drug use takes place, which allows us to very quickly get in and understand risk that may be changing because of the environmental context, like COVID-19 or new drugs or new issues. And the reality was, all of those things have been happening while the COVID-19 pandemic has been going on. We've had surges of high quality heroin, we've had surges of cocaine injecting, and we've had to respond to those issues as well as COVID-19. It's not just, we don't just stop doing that other harm reduction work. We have to maintain that as well. I think it's important to have this comprehensive understanding of harm reduction so that we don't get isolated into silos around HIV allows us to do work with people who inject drugs. Oh, but if you're smoking crack, I can't intervene. Or if you're chasing heroin, I can't intervene. I think we need to be much more nimble footed. And I think the UK, in its stepping back from harm reduction in the last period, has fallen behind some of our European partners in seeing the innovation. When I go to Dublin, when I go to Berlin, and we as drug users in the UK are now really offering to our government to help them catch up again after the very cautionary lessons that we learned by having a Glasgow, the HIV outbreak in Glasgow. And finally, I think that the other key lesson is that housing and employment are harm reduction. Now, the moving of, in the UK, they were expecting to have 5,000 homeless people coming off the street. 14,000 people came forward for housing off the streets. So I think we really need to understand the huge opportunities of finally getting the street homeless population off the streets, and we really need to take up the opportunities and think about how we engage that population. Lastly, the people who've really, really struggled have been the people who aren't able to beg, aren't able to shoplift, aren't able to get involved in low-level acquisitive crime. That group have really struggled, and I think we need to think about offering that group other ways of raising an income, like recharging electric scooters and bikes. Now, thinking of creative ways that people at the bottom end of the society can make money without resorting to crime when they're really struggling.
That was Matt Southwell, project manager for the European Network of People Who Use Drugs. He was participating in a webinar entitled "How is COVID-19 Shaping the Future of Drug Services in Europe?" that was hosted recently by the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.